It's not yet hectic in central Berlin on an end of summer Monday. As Berliners gradually return to work, for many it is difficult not to turn on to the energy issues afflicting the country. The recent announcement by Russia to halt gas deliveries to Germany via the key pipeline Nord Stream 1 for an indefinite period has sparked fears of power shortages next winter and fueled inflation.
Of course I'm worried. The energy crisis is a pressing issue for all Germans. We're moving back to coal-powered plants, and just some of our nuclear power plants are likely to be kept online. And the soaring price of energy, how could I not be worried?
Germany has been trying to reduce its natural gas usage by 20% to avoid an energy shortage this winter. Some large cities in the countries are limiting heating and turning off gas lights to save on natural gas. Germany has decided to replace all Russian energy imports, most notably natural gas, by as soon as the end of 2024. Moscow accounted for 55% of Berlin's gas imports in 2021, a level that declined to 26% by the end of June. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has so far met this gas challenge through a combination of measures, including diversified sources of LNG imports and subsidies.
Can Germany then completely avoid Russian gas? That's an important question. And that depends on several factors. The major factor is the ability of the states to provide LNG to Germany. And also the ability and the interest of Germany to subscribe contracts that are long-term contracts, 10-year contracts for LNG supply.
Meanwhile, German inflation hit almost 8% in August, and earlier this month, the Olaf Scholz government unveiled a new multi-billion euro relief package to help households cope with skyrocketing energy prices. On Monday, the IFO, Institute for Economic Research, predicted the German economy will fall into recession next year. IFO also warned that the first quarter of 2023 will be particularly rough for consumers, with inflation soaring to around 11%. Max Civili, Berlin.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise. And on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance. But for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing, with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis, I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Purizep, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban Deputy Economy Minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington's sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty. and 19 million people are facing food insecurity. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people. As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near-universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In the limelight.
By shying away from graphic images of death, news organizations sanitize the violence of Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Elise Swain and Alice Sperry, writers. This article is published under the heading Americans rarely see the true face of Israeli regime's bombing of Gaza. Here's the story. When a ceasefire ended a three-day Israeli regime offensive in the Gaza Strip, over 350 Palestinians were wounded and 46 were dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Media coverage in the U.S. was mainly led by photographs of smoke-filled skies or Gazans walking amid piles of rubble. While the photos were accurate and recent, the safety of selecting these images rather than graphic ones effectively portrayed a reality for American audiences far removed from what had truly unfolded on the ground. To look at the totality of images that are made during a news event is an experience most Americans, with the exception of photo editors in newsrooms, rarely experience. As the Palestinian death toll climbed over the weekend, images from photojournalists based in Gaza poured into massive databases like Getty Images and AP Images. A quick search for Gaza on Getty Images, for example, returns hundreds of recent photographs, a near endless grid of brutality from the last week. In many images, children killed by Israeli regime bombs are displayed prominently. These images show funerals, the faces of the deceased uncovered, their bodies held aloft and marched through the streets. In some photographs, mourners are seen taking their own images of the bodies on their cell phones, proof of what horrors have occurred. These graphic images are arrayed on photo databases next to the non-graphic images that are almost always selected for publication by U.S. news organizations. Rockets flying through the sky at night, quiet moments of children surveying the damage done to their homes, and black smoke rising over the horizon. In Gaza, photojournalists routinely photograph within hospitals and morgues. This access to urgent care facilities, rare in the United States, provides an opportunity for journalists to directly document the wounded and dead. On Getty Images, images of children's bodies wrapped in white fabric piling up at the morgue are abundant and uncensored. While shocking and deeply upsetting, they do show very clearly what bombing dense residential areas produces. I can still see the grieving people weeping after their homes were destroyed, Palestinian photojournalist Hossam Salem told The Intercept, adding, I can't handle it anymore. Even after these 3 days of Israeli regime attacks are over, I have become more drained than before. In Gaza, there are no stories that can give us life. All we can say is how death has taken our lives and the lives of those around us. We'll be right back. in general, the majority of coverage by international and American media is weak and often does not show scenes where innocent women and children were killed. Soleiman Haji, a Palestinian visual journalist working in Gaza, told The Intercept. In the case of one of the 16 children killed, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum, one report in the New York Times included a photograph made after her death. This was the exception, though the photo was not featured prominently. It was placed near the end of the article. Other outlets from the Washington Post to NBC News did not publish the image, even as they mentioned the girl's killing. What we are left with is, in essence, a sanitized and avoidant understanding of world events as newsrooms uniformly opt for images that do not include any graphic content. Social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have enforced this shift away from publishing depictions of violence by implementing sensitive media policies that discourage newsrooms from prominently displaying images of atrocities lest they lose page views. There is no consensus on how to deal with images of intense violence. Individual newsrooms make decisions on a case-by-case basis, often after sorting through troves of images filed to major distribution platforms where none of the images are blurred or censored. On getting images only within the caption information is there sometimes an editor's notes warning the viewer about what they're already looking at. Image depicts death. Most media outlets, including this one, issue an editor's note or content warning before surprising viewers with depictions of graphic violence. It is not just Palestinian bodies that are erased from mass media accounts of massacres. School shootings in America and the scenes that have become visually defined by makeshift memorials and candlelit visuals rather than graphic images. And the same is true for the bloodshed that occurs overseas, but there are exceptions. The problem with the representation of Palestinian life and death goes well beyond the images selected to tell the story. Palestinians and many foreign observers have long condemned the international media for sanitizing the Zionist regime's crimes and deferring to the Israeli regime's narrative. In a letter signed by more than 500 journalists following yet another Israeli regime bombing campaign on Gaza last year, the authors, including several Intercept reporters, argued that coverage of the Israeli regime and Palestine regularly amounts to journalistic malpractice. The asymmetry in context does not just extend to the language we use. Stories tend to disproportionately amplify Israeli regime narratives while suppressing Palestinian ones, the group wrote. Obfuscating Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians fails this industry's own objectivity standards. Ahmad Abu Artma, a Palestinian writer and human rights activist who in 2018 was one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, a peaceful protest movement by the fence separating the Zionist regime from Gaza, told Intercept that the Israeli regime operated on the assumption that they would have an ally in most of the international media. He said, "This is complicity. We don't want anything more than for people to know the facts. We don't have a complicated narrative. Our demand is only that people watch the facts, watch the reality, see the footage of what's happening." Across newsrooms, the safe choices of showing an abstracted violence, including calm moments of smoke and rubble, over overt violence, including death, injury, or mourning, fall in line with the framework of the coverage itself, which in Gaza's case regularly downplays the impact of civilians in favor of a narrative about Palestinian militancy, even as the same kind of militancy is depicted as resistance in Ukraine. Mohammad Mohawesh, an independent Palestinian journalist and researcher based in Gaza, argued in an interview with The Intercept that coverage of the latest Gaza assault, which Israeli regime officials admitted was preemptive, focused almost exclusively on the Zionist regime's ostensible justification for attack rather than its impact. And even though the majority of victims were not engaged in acts of resistance, the portrayal of Palestinian resistance, he added, stands in a stark contrast with that of the Ukrainian people. For the past month, newspapers and websites and social media have been filled with the stories of Ukrainian resistance and heroism, stories about soldiers blowing up bridges to delay the approach of Russian tanks and sacrificing themselves in the process. We have seen civilians attacking armed vehicles with whatever they have and common people receiving weapons training and digging trenches, Mohawesh said, adding, and yet, if any of these stories took place in Palestine rather than Ukraine, they would, of course, not be perceived as acts of heroism and resistance. They would only be classified and condemned as terror. Mohawesh stressed the comparison was not intended to diminish the resistance of the Ukrainian people, but to uphold the right to resist the occupation, military intervention of any land by any nation.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. sanctions severely impact human rights. That is a grim assessment by a top U.N. human rights official who has slammed the U.S. for its brutal sanctions regime against the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine her remarks not only about the brutal sanctions regimes that have been exercised on Iran, but also its impacts on other countries and why it rarely achieves U.S. objectives, if at all. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Frank Emspach joins us. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin who joins us from Madison. We also have Lambert Opec, former UK Member of Parliament, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Frank Emspach, let me first start with you. We have this lady who has a very full title, and I'm going to say it because it represents the weight of her position, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Negative Impact of Unilateral Coercive Measures on the Enjoyment of Human Rights. She spoke at the UNHRC today, and she referred to Iran's case when she had a mission, and she came to Iran from May 7th to the 18th. And basically, she said that decades of sanctions have wholly affected Iranian people's lives, particularly the low-income section of the society. Well, that's great for her to have highlighted this. I'm wondering what happens when you have a person of that position go in that forum, present the case overall, and then pinpoint to how it has affected Iranians' lives. What happens next?
Well, in the United States, nothing happens. It was not even covered with any. I didn't find that in any paper today or yesterday. So I think that the impact politically here is probably zero, unfortunately. I don't mean to be cynical about it, but I think that's the case. I think what's happening here worldwide is that the United States and its allies impose sanctions unilaterally. And increasingly, other countries are not so hot on this. For instance, India and China to start with, but all kinds of other countries that have trade relations with, say, Russia or trade relations with Iran or whatever. And these countries are being sort of dragooned into an opposition position vis-a-vis their trading partners because the United States or Great Britain controls the finances. And I think what's happening is that this is an increasingly negative situation for the United States. There's more blowback. People are ignoring the sanctions. But what they do is they usually raise the cost of living, which generally means that the lowest portion of the society, the lowest wage earners, are the ones that are hurt the most. And the objective here is very clear. It isn't just to bankrupt Iran or to hurt this or that oligarch. The objective is to cause social unrest so that, in theory, the countries that are the target of the sanctions will have enough internal problems so they'll do whatever it is that the United States wishes. And this is what's going on, and I think it's increasingly resisted by people. But politically, her statement, I couldn't find it in any media outlet in the United States.
Well, some of the statements that she made there, Lambert Opec, has to cover different facets of how sanctions affects people's lives. That we do know. And one of the things that maybe we can draw a parallel to or show that it is the case is how, led by the U.S., with the European countries following that lead, are the sanctions imposed on Russia, which is the largest by far of any country, I think, in the history of sanctions. The effect on people's lives, in particular in the U.K., we can see what has happened. And that translates into how people suffer as a result. Therefore, does the case come out here that sanctions affects people's lives negatively and there should be another route that should be taken, in particular by the U.S., which now in this case followed by the Europeans?
Absolutely. The answer is contained in your question. And the Russia situation is a case study in what my fellow guest has just said. First of all, they are designed to cause unrest because the sanctions don't harm Putin directly. He can still get a sandwich at lunchtime. But the intention is expressly to try to create social unrest so that the population lean on their leaders to act differently. But it just doesn't seem to work that way. I know a lot of people in Russia, and in some ways it's actually hardened their resolve against Putin. Maybe some of the oligarchs will be unhappy, but the general public think that Putin is fighting a just war. Not all of them, but many of them do. That doesn't get reported on this side. And I'm not making a judgment about who's right and wrong in Ukraine. I'm just talking about the sanctions.
Sure.
The second point here is they're counterproductive. The sanctions which have been imposed by Europe on Russia has harmed Europe because Putin said, you cause me pain, I'll switch off the gas, and then you've got a problem. And that's exactly what's happened. So now the energy policies across the United, the European Union have fallen into tatters. And then the third and the final point here is, I believe that using sanctions is a form of impotence. It means that you've got virtue signaling by politicians in the West who want to look like they're being tough, but you don't stop a war by harming the general population. And sanctions don't harm the generals. And so for that reason, those three reasons, places like Iran, they learn to adapt and they find new allies, China perhaps, maybe India, maybe Russia. And so the whole power situation shifts away from the countries that are imposing the sanctions and towards new allies. And that causes lasting damage, in this case, the United States and to the European Union, regardless of where you stand on, in this example, the war in Ukraine.
Sure. Well, Frank Imspach, looking at some of the ways that sanctions have been expressed by the U.S. and, of course, then executed, one of the things and statements, I should say, that really stands out is from the previous U.S. administration, which was headed by Donald Trump. And this really cut deep inside many Iranians when they read this piece of news, in particular, the then foreign minister of Iran. When the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, Iranian officials must listen to Washington if they want their people to eat.
Well, that's the theory. We've tried that with the Cubans since 1969. And, you know, I think you're trying to blackmail people here, and it doesn't work. People don't like that. But I think other things are also happening. And also, you do this sanction after sanction after sanction now for 15 or 20 years, it begins to undermine the financial stability that the United States prizes so greatly. Because after a while, countries say we cannot use this financial system controlled by Great Britain and the United States because they do these unilateral sanctions, freeze the accounts, our trade is just destroyed, and we can't do that. So what's really happening here, slowly but surely, you're beginning to have parallel systems built up. So not only is this bad, or it could be considered to be a war crime or a human right, certainly the kind of sanctions we had in Iraq,
exactly.
Where we denied water purification. I mean, what you're talking about here is our policies.
I'm
like,
sorry, what did you say about Iraq?
Well, during the Iraq, let's see, about 2004, 2003, somewhere in there, the United States had, you know, a trade embargo. And one of the things that was done was the denying water purification equipment to Iraq, chlorine and everything else. And the UN estimated that a couple of 100,000 young children died because of the poor water. That, you know, so in Madeleine Albright's response was, well, everybody has to pay a price. You know, you lose your complete moral authority here. And that is what's happening. And it's a short run situation here with long run consequences. But in terms of the first question, and this is what is so disturbing, there is no discussion of these matters in the popular press and amongst the politicians.
What do you think about what our guest there has said, Len Padopic, when we hear about what U.S. did in Iraq, combined with what did the I mentioned about the former Secretary of State Pompeo, that Iranian officials must listen to Washington if they want their people to eat. What does that show about the U.S.?
First of all, it convinces me that Pompeo will never, ever win an award for empathy. Secondly, while I'm not sure about the figures here, there's no doubt that lives were lost in Iraq amongst a population that wasn't even asking for war and certainly wasn't responsible for Saddam Hussein's worst excesses, because the Americans found it and the West found it easier to punish the public than to punish the leadership. And just if we needed any evidence whatever that sanctions don't work, and I'm really looking at the methodology of sanctions, I think the bankrupt methodology of sanctions. Think about one of the most sanctioned countries in the world, North Korea. They had enough resources to become a nuclear state, despite everything that was being done. Think about what's being done to Iran. Iran is being isolated because Iran doesn't play the Western ball game, not because Iran is some rogue state. They didn't kill 1.5 million people in Iraq in an unjustified war based on fake weapons of mass destruction. That was the West. So they're actually, on top of everything else, trying to impose their will by using sanctions and not succeeding. Iran was really the single state responsible for undoing the ISIL damage essentially created by the Americans. And then the third and final example, when you look at how sanctions have been imposed towards Russia, as we said before, it hasn't made a jot of difference to the military situation in Ukraine. It just caused hardship. Where do I go with this? Well, actually, the single best thing we could do, example of the United Kingdom, is actually extend a hand of friendship to these difficult countries. Whether you like Donald Trump or not, the most stable time we've had with North Korea in the last 20 or 30 years is whenever he seemed to be making friends with Kim Jong-un. You don't have to like either of the characters to recognize that talk was much more effective than trying to cut off the well-being, the health, and actually the life chances of children and others, whether it's in Iran or Iraq or anywhere else.
It was interesting to listen to Elena Doan speak, Frank Emspach, and one of the things that she mentioned was these secondary sanctions, and she kept repeating the destructive effects that has, which basically means if the U.S. sanctions a country, let's say Iran, then if another country is somehow or in one way or another exposed to Iran, whether it's financially or otherwise, that it's going to have secondary sanctions imposed on it. Doesn't this create more enemies for the U.S. when it goes and imposes the secondary sanctions to the degree that it does?
Of course. That's one of the shortcomings and one of the contradictions here. It's in the front page of the Wall Street Journal today that issues with the United States and China and the threat of sanctions, all these countries that are exporting to China or importing from China and have to use the SWIFT system or the banking system to do it are exposed here. And they're all worried about it. They all say so. And we're talking about the so-called third world who are exporting certain things to some countries. And these markets are cut off. So, of course, it's a no-win game for them. But, you know, one of the problems, of course, is the adage when elephants are fighting, everything gets trampled. And these countries are not powerful enough individually or collectively at this point to assert their own interests here. But certainly you build up a system of distrust and aggravation, and it undermines the ability to really achieve some kind of more just society here. I mean, that's what happens. And it's sanctions are a retrograde and ineffective on any basis, but they're retrograde and they're aimed at the population. And in that sense, we're talking about collective punishment and all of those types of things are what the United Nations says are banned.
Well, Len Piropec, the representative from Iran, also spoke at this forum, the UNHRC forum, Kazem Ghayrabadi, and he had the point of view on the exceptions that the U.S. has stated when it comes to sanctions, saying that that's just a mirage. That's false. Exceptions do not work when it comes to essentials and basics, especially medicine and foodstuff. Right here in Iran, there are people who are dying because they can't get the proper medicine because of sanctions. There's lots of food that is not able to be brought into the country. But in particular, the medicine aspect of it is killing people. What is it then that one can conclude other than the U.S. knows that yet it wants to put up a facade that, you know, there are exceptions. When, in essence, the U.S. knows that that doesn't work. It doesn't get to Iran, in the case of Iran.
There are three words that come to mind. Ignorance, cynicism, and hypocrisy. Ignorance because some... I don't really want to criticize people I don't know, but I want to criticize a policy that fails. Some people in America might really think that you can define in some patronizing way which sanctions are allowed and which sanctions are not. But it's idiotic. It's an idiotic attitude because sanctions generally harm the poor. We discussed that and we covered that. Secondly, cynicism, because the idea here, as we discussed earlier, is to get the public to turn against the leaders they think are causing these sanctions to be imposed. It's a ludicrous way of looking at things. And then the third point, in my view at least, is this concept that any of this is other than hypocritical. It's of course hypocritical. If countries like America and the European Union as a bloc and the United Kingdom preach to other countries about inhumane behavior, about human rights violations, and then do exactly the same en masse to millions of people who have never lifted a finger in anger to the countries that are imposing the sanctions. And that's why it's such a stupid policy, because you actually harm entire populations without really making much difference, and often ingraining a sense of distrust and dislike. Just one last point here. Maybe those small countries aren't strong enough to coalesce against places like America, but over time, you make enemies, and eventually they'll choose their opportunity, at least to isolate America, and that's happening anyway, or at most to really harm them. And who's building most of what America and Britain buys? It's actually China. There's another hypocrisy and a contradiction.
Frank Especk, our guest, pinpoints on a very important issue, and that is the making of enemies. Is the U.S. at all concerned that the enemies that it is making may translate into, in severe cases, a danger to U.S. national security? I mean, I could parallel that to the U.S. drone strikes that happened in Pakistan that actually made so many enemies against the U.S. Of course, that's just a parallel. But these sanctions that end up killing people, don't you think the U.S. should be worried about the enemies it's making?
Well, of course, but I think you see that now, and there's no, you don't have to make parallels. One of the reasons that many, many countries have not gone along with the United States demands in regards to Ukraine, and they've said so, is because that we're acting unilaterally, and these countries in Africa and Asia are aggravated and feel insulted by our activities in regards to sanctions and unilateralism, and they have refused, therefore, to back all these various moves against this, Russia in terms of the Ukraine. And so you're already seeing this kind of backlash, and we've already, the United States government has already raised issues about this and criticized some of these countries, but to no avail. And so what you're seeing here is is basically a weakening of the sanctions regime for the reasons that my colleague has said. But, you know, politically speaking, in this country, which is what you let off with, that type of discussion is not going on. And if we're going to move forward on this issue here as the most powerful country in the world, that kind of discussion about where we're going morally and ethically with these types of things has to become part of the political dialogue. And right now, we don't see that.
Well, one of the things outside of the humanitarian realm of this whole topic, Lempit Opec, is the fact that we should look at the business side of things, the financial losses that are incurred. Of course, financial losses are incurred on the country that are sanctioned, but many don't realize that also the country that is applying the sanctions, in this case, the U.S., and of course, other countries that follow the U.S. Line, they're the ones that are also missing out on revenues. The U.S. is missing out on billions of dollars in revenues of countries that it sanctions, money that it could use very well at this point and juncture based on the poor economic data coming out of the U.S. Is that something that people actually take note of or not?
Let's shift from hypocrisy to irony. The politicians seem to be able to weather a storm that they don't actually have to sail through because it's business that suffers. So you're absolutely correct when you say what you've said, because we live in a global economy. And if America doesn't buy your products, or if America tries to stop you receiving things, then you'll sell them and buy them from somebody else. It's no coincidence that China owns a very large proportion of the assets in Africa, because when colonialism did its damage, China said, well, come in and we'll help sort things out. And they've got a huge amount of influence there. Back to the example of Russia and its energy and the European Union. The European Union imposed sanctions on Russia. They said, we're going to switch your gas off. Now we have an energy crisis, which directly leads to the cost of living crisis, where inflation is as high now as it was in 1982 in the United Kingdom 40 years ago. So the boomerang effect comes into play here. That's why this is a ludicrous policy, when all you really should be doing, instead of sanctions, especially if you're not at war with a country, is saying, let's work together, let's be interdependent, because when you're interdependent, it's very hard to fight a war. Perhaps it's a different situation with Russia, but wherever you stand on the Ukraine conflict, whoever you think is right and wrong, sanctions won't make a significant difference to the outcome, because when you impose them, there aren't winners, there are degrees of losing. But at the moment, it looks like the European Union is suffering more than Russia itself.
Final question, Frank Emps, back to you. We're looking at what is happening with the U.S. vis-a-vis Russia. We're looking at the upcoming conflict, which it seems like it's actually here, and that is the way that the U.S. is provoking China. We're looking at many countries who are deviating away from the U.S. line when it comes to its foreign policy. Do you think that there's a point that's being reached very soon on the horizon where countries, especially China, will then turn to sanctioning the U.S.? I mean, could that be a possibility where the U.S. then begins to suffer?
Well, of course, it's a possibility, and we'll see what happens. Clearly, there's going to be a shift in power coming in the next 30 years or 20 years, and maybe even sooner, along with a climate catastrophe. So clearly, there's going to be power shifts in many, many ways. You know, if the United States is in control of the financial system and we're running out of money or going bankrupt or using this in ways that are counterproductive, clearly it's going to be undermined and we are no longer going to be in that position. So certainly we're going to see a blowback here where other countries finally say, no, the Chinese already set up, you know, a world banking system with Africa and Asia. It just hasn't taken off in the same way ours has, but it's there and it's functioning and people are using it, and it didn't exist 10 years ago.
Thank you for that, Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin. Lebit Opik, thank you, former UK Member of Parliament. Thanks so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.